Welcome to the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Turk. Join me as we dive into the personal stories of some of the world's best hospitality professionals. We follow the journey of their ups, downs, and wild turns to find out what it truly takes to make it in the amazing world of hospitality. Listener, if you're running a hospitality business, you already know the work doesn't stop. And most of the time, it's not even the guests that wear you out. It's everything happening behind the scenes. That's why I'm really glad to introduce you to Lodgify, our sponsor for this episode. Lodgify is an all-in-one platform that helps short-term rental hosts and hospitality operators stay organized without needing a dozen different tools. You can manage reservations, keep your calendars synced, communicate with guests, and even collect payments all in one place. And if part of your goal this year is to drive more direct bookings, Lodgify also makes it easy to build your own website so guests can book directly with you. Plus, and I love this one, they include free onboarding so you're not figuring everything out on your own. If you like to spend less time managing the chaos and more time focused on hospitality, try Lodgify with a 60% discount on all their yearly and bi-yearly plans with our code THM60, and that's THM60. Now, back to the show. Welcome to another episode of the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. And today, listeners, I'm excited for this one. We've got Elizabeth Mullins, president of Evermore Hospitality, with us here today. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Steve, thanks so much. I'm excited too. It's an honor to be part.
Well, Elizabeth, we always start every podcast the same way, and then we're going to get into your journey. But what was your very first job in hospitality?
My very first job was a server. So that was my very first job. And so as soon as I became old enough to serve, I think, you know, back in the day, I was like 18 or whatever, I served and I bartended and I started to dabble into management in restaurants. And so I came up that way. And then my first job in hotels was a management trainee at the Ritz-Carlton.
Very nice. So you started off right. So what was that restaurant that you started in when you were a teenager? Was that a high school job that you had?
It was a high school job. So the first one was called the Lobster Shack. And I did everything in there. I was behind the bar. I was in the kitchen. I think I still have scars on my hand from the fryers. And I kind of learned a fast-paced rhythm that, and if you could do that with a smile and serve those clams and those lobster rolls, you're a winner. And so.
Was that in the Northeast? Is that where you were?
Yes, it was in New Hampshire, right on the seacoast.
Very nice. So you grew up there.
Yeah, I did.
Nice. I was looking back, I wanted you to talk about Evermore a little bit, but you got really the bug at 5 years old with your dad taking you into a Ritz-Carlton. Is that what I read correctly?
You did. And so it was Christmas time, and my father said, I'm going to take you to go see the Nutcracker Ballet. I remember nothing about the Nutcracker Ballet, but I remember everything about our first stop, which was the Ritz-Carlton Boston. And I walked in the door, the doorman, his name was Norman. He knew my dad's name and welcomed us by name. And so then I walked in and I had little shiny shoes on. And I remember the click, 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 click that they made across the lobby. And it smelled like cinnamon and pine because it was decorated for the holidays. Wow. And back then you used real trees and real garlands. So it had that smell. And then we walked in the back, which was the tea lounge, and there was a lady playing the harp, and I heard the harpist for the first time, and I felt very bougie. And then we sat down, and I had tea and hot chocolate and little pastries and finger sandwiches, and I looked at my dad and said, Daddy, this is what I want to do. And he looked back at me and said, no, it's not what you want to do, it's how you want to feel. So those two things are different.
Yes.
But I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And so I literally, you know, I would beg on vacations to just stay at hotels. I didn't care if we leave them. I just like poking around. I was 6 or 7. I was like a hotel sleuth. And when I went to college, I got a degree in hospitality. And my father actually said, you're going to get a degree in hospitality. If you want me to help you with college, you'll really get a degree in business. So I got both. I was able to get both. But the joy of it is that 6 days after I graduated from college, literally just 6 days, I started at that same hotel, that Ritz-Carlton in Boston.
The same one?
As a management trainee.
Incredible.
And as a management tree, we did everything. So, you know, I'd be serving breakfast one day and cleaning rooms the next day and stomping divots on the polo field the third day. Because the GM would raise his hand and say, trainees, stomp the divots. And we'd run out onto the polo fields and stomp them all down. It's all great fun for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And Ritz-Carlton was a baby company back then. So
when you started
hotels.
Right. Because I think you started like 1990, I would say, right?
Yeah, just about. Yeah, just about. And so with only six hotels, when I left, which was 28 years later, it was 99. So I grew up with the company grew up with me, and it all started with that one visit when I was five. So think about that, Steve. I mean, it's amazing how much impact that we have without even knowing it, because it was impactful enough to change my entire adult life.
It's amazing. It's a story. It kind of reminds me of mine, of how I got into hospitality. It was like my dad. Is a great attorney, still is a fantastic attorney. I always tell him to slow down. He listens to every episode. You got to slow down a little bit now. But he represented the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach.
Goodness.
And I remember walking in as a kid. We stayed in the Frank Sinatra suite because his best friend was the hotel manager. And then the Elvis Presley suite. I was like, what is this world? And I could pick anything I wanted because they weren't charging him at the time. And I was like, wow, I get to go see the chef. I get to see these things. It really stuck with me. And when I was studying to become a lawyer, I said, man, this is terrible. I don't like this.
Don't look terrible.
He's like, well, you learned hospitality, and that's how I ended up back. So similar with just talking, I was thinking about my journey. Now my daughter, you know, I take her to all these nice places, and we're just talking about it, and my son. So let's see what imprint I'm making on them. But the hotel life has changed a lot since you were there, and since I've started, it's continued to evolve. But let's talk about that time you had at Ritz-Carlton. You had 28 years, right? And some people may say the whole time, and I'm all on your entire career, like an interviewer. But what were some of the high points you had? Because you did work in so many countries and so many hotels. I'm sure you got to work with Horst Schultze and the owners and the people that were really setting the tone of what everyone copies now. Yeah. So what was it like for you?
So first of all, Horst is a mentor. And to be in the room with his electricity and passion and charisma is something very special to this day. So I saw him a few months ago, and he was simply Horst, just the same way he was to me when I was a young 20-year-old starting in the business. And so I found a business that you can really love because it's ever-changing. And we're in the business of memories. And so when you get to be in the business of memories, that's very special. And so literally over time, I just got better at creating those memories through a team of people. But I rose in the ranks from a management trainee, and you've got to remember at the time, Ritz-Carlton was expanding pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so literally, if you were the person that said, pick me, I'll go anywhere and raise my hand and say, you know, just pick me. I don't know, one in three times I'd be picked. Maybe I was the only one that was raising my hand, but I was not afraid to move. I was excited by it. Part of the reason I wanted to be in the industry was to have a great adventure. And that's what it gave me. And so each job came relatively quickly, but I always had the foresight to make sure that every day I looked myself in the mirror and said, are you the best in the world at this? It wasn't like I spent 2 weeks at the front desk and thought I could move again. Right. I gut checked myself and said, do I know everything about this role? Am I the best in the world at this? And then if I answered truthfully to myself, a yes, then I'd start to raise my hand for the next one. And what's really interesting is, though, although I raised my hand, you're typically tapped for your next job in hospitality, right? So people find you. And so I moved from Boston to New York to Washington, D.C., and then had the opportunity to go and help bring the brand into Asia at the Ritz-Carlton in Hong Kong. It was the early 90s. So it was Wild West and in Hong Kong and China. And I stayed there for almost a decade, about 8 years.
Wow.
And I was able to open with the Ritz, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Osaka, Tokyo, Bali, Kuala Lumpur, Seoul, I'm missing a couple of Singapore, but you get the picture. I think there were 10 over the course of that time. And literally, that's a portion in time that I had that I am so grateful for, because I got to understand other perspectives from around the world. And it really, what this period of time did was ensure that I deeply understood the craft of hospitality, because it's a craft.
Right.
It's not just a business. And so you've got to be really good at your craft. And working in Asia at those times, where Asia was remarkably better than the United States in those days in terms of service and true hospitality. So when I came back, kicking and screaming, because I didn't want to come back. I didn't want to. I was pregnant with my daughter, and the company was like, I'm on back. So I came back, and I had to almost learn to be an American again. But I was able to bring all these lessons learned back to the hotels that I was now starting to run. And so those 8 years, I was able to progress in my career, open all these products. I worked really hard to get there, but then I was able to come back and enjoy the journey as a general manager. And at that point in time, so I had done city hotels in the US, city and resort in Asia, came back and spent a lot of time in resort. So the Ritz-Carlton Kapalua, the Ritz-Carlton Laguna Niguel, the Ritz-Carlton in Palm Springs called Rancho Mirage. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, almost a decade of my time. And then I got sucked back into the city side of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, did Washington, D.C. for a long time, New York a couple times, Philadelphia, et cetera, et cetera. And at some point along that journey, I think I was a GM 9 times with Ritz. It was either 8 or 9 times with Ritz-Carlton. I was promoted to an area vice president. And so I would oversee region, still boots on the ground, because I'm a hotelier by trade.
I was gonna say.
And so I was able to actually oversee regions. And that's where I kind of took it from being in the hotel business to being in the business of hotels. So yes, there was something to learn there too. Yes. They were different lenses. And so that's where I started to learn how to think like an owner who's typically in the real estate business, understand what they were looking for, because it wasn't
finance. You get the money out. Yep. Holy thing. Yep.
How important cash flow was, how important, right? Equal to them is guest scores. And so I got to learn this other edge of the business that was really interesting. So at this point, I'm based in New York out of the Ritz-Carlton in Central Park. And we received an incredible honor of being the number one hotel in travel and leisure for America. And so there was a story written about me in like Delta In-Flight magazine or something. And Bob Chapek from Disney at the time, who was the number two, read the story and said, you know, our parks are best in the world. We don't always know that our hotels are, so go and get her. And I got a call from Disney and said, I'm a luxury girl. Why do you want me?
Right.
But, you know, after speaking to them, they didn't speak traditional hotel language that I was used to. They spoke into a language of execution and scale that I wasn't used to, because even at Walt Disney World, it's 32,000 rooms in one site. And being able to sort of get in there and understand and learn that, go back to development also. So be able to sort of imagine a corporate office that is your hotel company. That's what I ran there. And a lot of that was on development and renovation and repositioning the hotels globally around the world. But I did that for 7 years. And
yes, and I want to pause here. We covered so much here. You covered so many.
Yes, I know.
And I want to rewind, because selfishly, I want to learn more about some of your story, because
sure.
You don't hear a lot about people going to Asia and staying for 10 years and not wanting to come back. And it sounds like you met your husband there in
Asia?
No,
I met my husband before I went. He's actually from Hong Kong.
Oh, my
gosh. Yeah. It was bizarre that I was given this position and he was like, hell yeah, we weren't married yet. We got married in Hong Kong, but yeah, let's go. It's going to be a great adventure.
We get there. So, you know, was your family like encouraging you to go and, oh, she's going to be back in a year? And then you stayed for that long?
I think my family was just confused by it all, right? I think they thought I'd stay
like, where are you going?
In the Boston area, and that just was not for me. Do I think they put a time stamp on it? Probably. They probably thought I'd be back in a year or two. Right. But so if you want me to dig in, I'll tell you that my first year was rough because I approached everything as an American. And I had to give that up. I had to, you know, have a conversation with myself that said, if I'm going to live in this country, I'm going to live it like a local. We say that now, it's very common, but back then you didn't.
It was like the Airbnb says.
But it was true. The minute I embraced the culture as my own, I loved it so much. And I never thought I would come back to the States. It was honestly when I came back to the States, because I didn't come back very often. Maybe once every 3 years. It was a really long trip.
They were not coming back because holidays are busy. You're not coming back for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I know that's the reason I want you to dig in a little bit, because there's a lot of people who get these offers and they're like, I don't know if I want to go be an expat. I don't want to do this. That's why I want you to talk a little bit about it.
Yeah. So my first piece of advice is do it. Jump on it and do it, because it's a resume builder like you've never seen. The fact that you actually have multidiscipline, so city, resort, and then US-based and international, is huge. It tells people you can acclimate, you know how to think, right? You have courage, you like to explore, like all of these traits that owners, general managers, and companies look for, it gives you that. So it bolsters your resume in an incredible way. And so my advice would be just jump on it and do it. And so it is one of the things that I am so proud of that I did, especially at that young age. I mean, I was in my early 20s and I was fearless, right?
I'm glad that you did that, because your story now is so much more in depth here. And part of it you mentioned that struck me was that they were doing hospitality better than we do in the U.S. when you were there. And so this was always my question. I worked at Mandarin Oriental and it was in Miami, and they would always compare us to the one in Bangkok and the ones in Asia. And I was like, yeah, but I don't have as many staff members as they do to get you the scores that you are. Was I saying the right thing, or was just the hospitality way better? What was
No, 100%. A lot of it, like if I'm honest, a lot of it was the guests to staff ratio. Well, that made a huge difference.
Right.
But I also will say that just even culturally, people were just more hospitable.
Yep.
Sometimes in the U.S., we have to, you know, really think about being hospitable. And there, the service culture is just so deep. So in that aspect, I was able to garner a lot from that. And you know what I took away? My biggest lesson there was I can only go so far at teaching people how to love other people.
Yes.
You actually have to find the people that have that in their heart. And so if someone loves hospitality, you're able to teach and mentor and grow. If someone struggles with that part of hospitality, this probably isn't the journey for them. They'll just never find it joyful.
Yeah, they're just going to feel like, oh my, I got to go again. All these people are going to ask me for stuff.
Right. Split. Exactly.
I'm really glad to hear that, because that's what always kind of stuck in my head. I've only got to go to Thailand. I haven't explored Asia all that much, but my brother just got back from Japan. He was like, man, I dropped some napkins and everyone came running to help me. He was like in shock. And when he came back to the U.S., he's like, oh my gosh, this would never happen here. They would just like walk by me and won't let it happen. But he always wants to go back. Let's go. All right. So I want to jump back forward now. So we talked a little bit about it. So you have this decision to make with Ritz-Carlton, where you get called by Disney, the number two. I think he was CEO at one point, the gentleman that called you. To leave something after 26 years is a big decision. Or was it not? Were you just like, all right, I've done it here. I'm already doing regions. I'm burnt out here. Or was it just an offer that was tempting to refuse?
It was. I'm surprised I did it. So as much courage as it took to go to Asia in my early 20s and explore Asia for almost a decade, leaving Ritz-Carlton after 28 years took the same amount of courage. And so I thought I would be with them forever. But I realized I had more to learn, right? And I had more to give. And I also found myself knowing the answers to almost every question that was asked of me without a great deal of work in getting that answer. I had just done it so many times that I knew what was coming. I knew exactly, you know, how to handle it because the crisis I had already gone through six times before. And so
here's a playbook. This is what we do.
Exactly. And I, you know, I helped write the playbook, so I knew the playbook. And so I took the leap, and it was a leap. It was a leap to, for, as I mentioned before, to a company that didn't speak the same language that I spoke, right? So, and for me to understand culturally how to make workflow through a system. Like, I had been with Rich so long that I knew everybody. I could just phone a friend whenever I needed. And you had to build all those relationships again. And then you had to think in terms of a huge scale, which was mind-blowing. And so I worked through the pandemic with Disney, which was really interesting because we shut everything down and then had to open it back up. But I got to do things like be one of the three people that ran the NBA bubble. Right. So it was things like that that were really interesting.
So let's talk about that, because you got recruited as vice president, hotels and premium services. So what does that mean? What did you get recruited to do when you started? What was the job?
Yeah. So the job, the hotel part of the job was to reposition our hotels in terms of not changing their story, because Disney has pretty profound stories for each one of their hotels, but reposition them for the modern traveler. And so, or build more. And so I think I helped develop about eight more when I was there over the 7 years and renovated almost all of them throughout the world, you know, part and parcel, of course, with the teams, but was able to give a lot of thought into how we should recreate what our hotel company did. And then I also took on the responsibility of a business called Premium Services. And that has everything to do with the affluent consumer, which, of course, was my background. So, you know, that part was super fun. It was, if you go to the parks and you see someone in a plaid vest, their VIP tour guide, and they can weevil you through the parks and get you to the front of the line, etc. Yes. And so I oversaw that team, as well as a very secret club called Club 33 within the Disney ecosystem. So that as well. And a beautiful neighborhood in Walt Disney World called Golden Oak. And so those three things were the premium services side of the team. And I was so lucky because the teams that I helped lead were so strong in and of themselves. So it was really fun.
Yeah. And so for listeners, this is not just Orlando. This is all of the hotels that you're working on, right? Yeah. Is somebody getting that right? So you do
That's right.
Yeah. And it's just amazing what you all have done there. I was just at the Wilderness Lodge. We spent, you know, a couple of days there, which was great.
It.
You know, Animal Kingdom, we stayed at several times. I told you my kids are 10 and 8 now. And so, you know, I've become an expert, I feel like, at the parks and the hotels and how to get the best out of them. But you do a fantastic job. And one of my favorite things is I don't need a front desk. Was that part of what you were doing when you were there?
It sure was. Yeah.
What was that like for a lot of people? Because I could imagine you doing this at Ritz-Carlton. They're like, no, we're here at high touch. We don't want people just going off to their room, you know, but at Disney, it's one of my favorite things where I don't need the front desk assists me, but I don't have to go there. I can just go straight to
grab.
Was that part of what you were working on?
It was. And so the whole thing was to try to make travel easy and to strip away any friction points that you have. And so when you're doing things at a massive scale, you have to think differently. It might be okay if you have 30 check-in, but what if you have 3,000? Then you have to actually be thinking about how do I get people to really start their vacation early and skip the things that are simply tactical. And so that's what we did there. And I would have arguments all the time, but people still want to see Sally at the front desk. And I would say they have their entire vacation to see Sally. What they really want is to go to their room, to unpack, to settle, and then to go out and enjoy. That's really how we can help them.
Yes.
And so that doesn't mean, and I hope you've noticed this, that doesn't mean that the warm welcome went away. It just means that you didn't have to take that extra stop when you didn't need to.
No, I felt it. If someone was waiting at the door for us, we were there a couple of weeks ago. So if somebody came in, welcomes at the door. I like being in the bubble there. I want to talk about Evermore too, because I'm curious about how you see those two things in Orlando. But yeah, as I was there, I was curious because different than Ritz-Carlton, you have a lot of affluent travelers there. They're all the time. And Disney, it seems like there's two camps, like someone who saves up all this money as like their big trip for the first time in years and they want to go. And then you have the others where I saw there's some rooms that are 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 a night at these properties. Was there talks internally about those things, or was it we take care of everyone exactly the same?
Oh, of course. But, you know, Disney is about giving everybody a beautiful stay. That's what it's about. And I actually walked away appreciating the people that saved for those vacations so much. And really your desire to give them the most beautiful stay is enhanced because they really worked to make sure that their family had the opportunity to go to Disney World. And it was really lovely. And so it was a part of me, I hope, that I still carry to this day.
Yeah, I can see it. A lot of people have that picture on their mantle. That's what I always thought in hotel. Like, people paying all this money, this picture is going to be on their mantle. Let's make sure it's a good memory for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're at Disney. You are doing a great thing there. You talked about all the fun things that you've done. I'm sure there's a thousand other stories, and we need a whole other podcast just for that, for all the Disney fans that listen. But then you make a change. It's an interesting change. You know, what happens there when you decide to make a change for yourself?
So I think if you would have listened to me over the 7 years, I had said something to the effect of, you know, I will always want to go back and be a GM or managing director again, because it's truly what lights me up. And I really would love to do an independent, because I had worked for two big behemoths.
Mega. Yeah.
And I had made this list of all of the things that I could do at an independent. And I started seeing the cool kids being born, which was all of these great independent hotels. And I'll be honest with you, I had a little bit of jealousy at the fun they looked like they were having. Yeah. And so I just really wanted to try it. And this is an important one, Steve, because in order to make that decision, I had to release my golden handcuffs, right? Because these are two different things. And I remember the conversation with my husband that was, I've worked really hard all of these years so that I can make decisions like this one, where I actually just take a job because it's truly what I want in my heart. And so that's when I was able to become the COO and the managing director of Flaneur Hospitality and opened the Fifth Avenue Hotel. So the Fifth became sort of the cool cat in the New York City hospitality landscape when we opened it in late 2023, October 16th, 2023. And I have to give credit to the young owner, his name's Alex Oheb Shalom. And Alex had this vision. He's not a hotelier. He loved staying in hotels. He'd never run one before. But his perspective was, somehow the industry has gotten a bit beige. Let's blow that up, start again, bring back high touch service into a really high designed environment. And that's what we did. And so we found ourselves, and I had an incredible team, we found ourselves winning all of these awards.
We won, and
I think we were the most awarded independent hotel in the U.S. Two Michelin keys year one, et cetera. 50 best in the restaurant, 50 best in the bar. And it was a joy. It was an incredible joy to be part of that journey and to be able to like fulfill that dream of mine to work for an independent. And so I loved every moment of that. Interestingly enough, I have to go to New York tonight for business. Of course, I'm staying at the Fifth. So I can't.
Well, you left on good terms then, is what it sounds like.
Yes. I actually am still on Alex's advisory board today.
Good, good. I'm happy that, because there's something interesting about going to independent like that. I'm sure for you, after being in these mega companies where you are the one making the decisions, you are the one who's like, all right, there is no SOP for this. Where do I pull this power up? Right. I'm sure you're like, where's the book? Hey, HR, where? No, Elizabeth, you tell us what you want. Is that what it was like?
Yeah, it was. And you know, you'd have times where, gee, I think I need to consult an attorney on this one. Huh. Who do I call for that? Oh, I need to find one. It's those moments that you have that are so precious because you don't realize when you work for a brand how much work is done behind the scenes. You kind of think it's all you, selfishly. Think it's all you. There's a tremendous amount of work that's done behind the scenes. The biggest lesson for me, Steve, was understanding how distribution works. And so if you're with a Disney or you're with a Marriott, Ritz Carlton, you show up at a new hotel and you plug in your systems and you're connected. Mm-hmm. And at an independent, you have to figure out that myriad of ways to actually get yourself noticed against these big brands that had incredible bandwidth. And so it was so interesting to learn that. I mean, I went back to school. I got certificates in marketing and distribution, and I found great partners along the way because I had to know. And I didn't know from all of this time in my career because it was taken care of for me.
Yeah, so how did you do that? Because I'm actually building a unique independent hotel right now. It's an agrotourism play. We have wellness. We're on a farm. We just signed a 99-year lease on a 25-acre farm, and we're building these cool bungalows. What would be some advice that you would give to me about getting it out there? How would you say, Steve, this is what you got to make sure we learned at the end? Yeah, so listeners, now we're doing a little case study for me.
Terrific. Right.
So I would say a couple things. Number one, farm tourism is so hot right now. Good for you that you're doing it. I'm so excited by the movement. I just love it. And so, you know, I think it's going to be very successful. I tried, failed, tried, failed, tried, failed, tried, failed. And finally, I found a company that would help me get me over the line. And there are companies that are out there that literally helped build the quagmire that are distribution systems. It's worth the investment.
Tell me offline. You'll tell me offline.
I will. I'll tell you exactly who to reach out to, but
that's amazing.
That's the only way, right? Even at Evermore, when I got to Evermore, same thing. But I already knew because I'd already suffered when I was at the
I got it. So you built this amazing hotel. I was looking at the website that I hadn't heard of it until I started researching your background. It's beautiful. And I see all the awards and the reviews are still going really well. So you helped build that culture there. What was it like putting your culture in? Because you had Ritz Carlton background, Disney background. You've been doing and dreaming about this since you're five. What was it like when you said, this is going to be the culture? How did you help create it? Was it with the owner? Was it your team? Like, how did you decide to do that?
It was hand in hand with the owner and with the team that we had assembled at the time. You know, I had worked for two cultural powerhouses.
Yes.
So I knew what good culture was, right? So I had that in my playbook. And an advantage is I didn't know what bad culture is. Like, I'd never experienced it.
Right.
And you tend to hire and select people with you that had the same cultural bias. And so all of our team at the Fifth, the senior leadership team, the most important thing we said we did was create a strong culture. And we hired this interesting company out of the UK called Empowered. And, you know, it's typical that hotels do engagement surveys. They don't survey that way. They actually survey your employees to measure culture. And we started that measurement tool 3 months after we opened the doors. And we did it every quarter thereafter to ensure that culture remained strong. Because again, there was no corporate person looking over my shoulder saying, this is how you compare to this landscape. Here's the data. Here's the facts. So it was really critical for us to make sure we measured ourselves along the way. And I think, you know, a hotel company's first year, 90% turnover is the average in first year. That's kind of brand and independence aligned. And I think mine was a 27% turnover. So we were able, I think part of measuring that culture meant in real time, I would have the pulse of how people were feeling and what we needed to do more of. How could we make people feel more valued, et cetera. And so that shaped that landscape. And they still, right, they still have that beautiful culture today.
So did you make everyone hold a credo card? That's
no.
That's my one question.
I didn't make everybody hold one, but we had something very similar. So we did. Because you've got to write it down. That's holding yourself accountable. If it's not written down, there's no accountability. So we didn't make everybody carry it. Hopefully they carry it in their heart. right? That's the game. But we spoke about it every day in every lineup on every shift. Culture was the first thing we spoke about.
I have to. That's what I've seen at all the hotels. I'm sure you've seen it too. If you're not doing it, I'm sure you could walk into a hotel now and you know if it's going well or not just by 100%. The first 5 minutes of walking in.
That's right.
Right. Just so they know what they're doing. So
that's right.
I do agree on that. And it's something I've been reminding myself not to forget as I've been out of the hotel world for a couple of years and while we're building our stuff. So, all right, you're doing a great job. You built a fantastic independent hotel. You've got great culture there. You seem to be a rock star. What happens? Something changes here for you and you end up back in Orlando. How does that change happen? You know, I think a lot of people are going to be like, wow, it sounds like you had what you wanted.
I had 100% what I wanted. I had 100% what I wanted. I'm living in New York, living my best life. I have a great owner. I'm in this award-winning jewel box. I was so happy. And then suddenly someone shows up in my lobby and said, hey, Elizabeth, we've been searching for you. I was like, you've been searching for me. That sounds ominous.
Yeah.
Who are you? They said, hey, yeah. Can we just sit down and buy you a drink? And I said, well, I've got a few things right now. And I figured I'll buy them a drink if they're still here when I get back. And so I was gone for like 45 minutes. I had to touch a few tables in the restaurant, meet a guest, blah, blah, blah. I came back. They were still there. We went into the portrait bar and they said, hey, you have something that's really interesting to us is that you've worked at scale. You all know the Orlando market because you were based out of there for 7 years at Disney. You have a whole lot of time running luxury hotels, and there's not that many people that actually know both luxury and large scale, and right. Especially where it's near to the mouse. So we represent a company called Evermore. And I said, Evermore, I know Evermore. I know Evermore because my second week working at Disney looked at the land that Evermore now owns. And I was on a trip looking at the land with them. And I thought the land was really beautiful. And so it didn't go that way, right? Obviously, Dart Interest purchased the land. Who I work for is my ownership company. They purchased the land. But I remember, like, it was so intriguing for me that as Evermore was first started being developed, they had created a berm on the outside that so you couldn't see in what was being developed. But I'm a curious hotelier. So I would drive home and I would pass the site. And sometimes I'd pull over on the side of the road. I'd walk up the berm and I'd look over and see what they were building. Mind you, I had no thought in my mind that I'd ever work at Evermore. This is just happenstance, right? So now it's January 1st or January 2nd. It was January 3rd. And Evermore had opened 2 days before. And I flew that weekend. I flew to Florida and I stayed the night in the Conrad Hotel, which is the luxury anchor, and walked the property and flew back. I just needed to see what I had been looking about. At this point in time, the people had not reached out to me. I didn't. I had no idea about it. I just went on my own course. So when they showed up and had this conversation with me, I was obviously intrigued. Because I already had this little magnet, right? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't think that I would take the role, but I was happy to have a conversation with the person that's my now boss. And his name is Chris. And I had a conversation and he was fascinating. And so I really enjoyed the conversation about building an entire hotel company around togetherness. And the way travel should bring people together. So you creating these family memories, either a large family or a large group of friends or colleagues in shared accommodation spaces that now take what Airbnb has tried to do it right, because it'll have the right amount of bedrooms, all like primary suites with a bathroom attached. Yeah. The right amount of common space, which usually you never get both, right? And so one of them's missing. You don't have the right amount of bedrooms. Right. You don't have enough couch space to all sit in the living room together. You don't have a table that's, if your house can sleep 22, you have a table that fits 12. In our houses, if your house can sleep 22, your table can fit 24.
Right.
In case you have another few friends come and visit. And so I was fascinated by this concept. And mind you, the year before, the Surgeon General had just come out and said, the U.S. is facing this epidemic on loneliness. And so I had been listening about the loneliness epidemic. And in my head, as a hotel person, I'm thinking, wow, we have some responsibility in this. How travel to us, how can we make them more lonely along the way? And service culture would say, hey, you know, there's no one better than a bartender at making you feel less lonely.
Yeah. So
that bartender has a conversation with you and you walk out and you feel heard. So that's this moment of solace. But it was the first time I had ever heard someone say, we built a hotel company around the concept of togetherness. And it was that statement that really caused me to take the leap and become president of Evermore. It's not that I wanted to. I gave Alex, I think, 60 days notice. His mantra to me was I had to find my replacement and train them. And I did. And she's so much better than I was. It's amazing. Shout out to Carla. She's amazing. And so literally, I gave up something that I loved so much to do this because the concept was so unique, different, and I felt attached to it. So here I am.
I think it's amazing. So listeners, that's a great story that Elizabeth just shared with us. And I want you to pause if you're not driving, if you're walking, just pull out your phone, check out evermoreresort.com. All right, I think that's the right website to send them to. It's beautiful. And if you haven't seen this before, and I've seen now pictures and videos, and I'm ashamed that I have not been there yet because this lagoon in the middle, it looks like another world. You have golf courses. And the thing that did catch my eye when I started to hear about Evermore the first time was because when I left hotels, I also had a vacation rental management company down here in South Florida where we manage a bunch of single family homes. Now I think we're up to like 60 some of them. And it's hard to do because you're spread out and you have to try to set the standards for all these things and put them in place. But you all built it with that in mind. And so that was something unique to me. They're starting to pop up more and more now, but I think you're truly the one big resort that I've seen that really has luxury hotel with Conrad. Yeah. And then you have these vacation rentals. How did you start thinking about the service for that? Who is running those for you? Is it different companies? Is it?
No, it's all us.
So it's all you.
So imagine that we are a hotel and our accommodations happen to be villas, flats, and homes that range from 4 bedrooms to 11 bedrooms.
Right.
So an 11-bedroom house can sleep 32. And I have 300 plus of those accommodation space on top of the Conrad, right? So there's the Conrad and then 300 plus. And so if you consider that Evermore is large format hospitality, you know, there can be up to 10,000 people on site at any given moment.
Yes.
So we're big. We are a whole city. And as you mentioned, the since it's a concept of togetherness, we had to develop something that would be built together. You kind of see a bunch of swimmers in a blue thing behind me that's Evermore vibes. But it is a 20-acre crystal lagoon. The water body is 8 acres, which means you can paddleboard. We have little motor boat rides. You know, there's all sorts of water sports. You can kayak and canoe and all of these things. Swim, of course. And then around that are all the accommodations. And three times around Evermore Bay, you get your 10,000 steps in.
And
on top of that, you've got our two PGA golf courses, 14 food and beverage outlets around the bay. I just have this map commissioned. I'm going to hold it up. So this map
the amazing artist map. I love those.
Isn't this great?
That's so cool.
It shows the scale and the fun of what Evermore is. And so imagine now you've got a brand that's built on togetherness, where we can take that. And so it doesn't always have to be a lagoon purpose, right? It's just a moment. I can imagine in the mountains, the coolest après-ski that's ever been seen, right? And who knows what that concept is that brings people together in the large format hospitality space. And so Evermore, I think, is really one to watch. I think that, and I wasn't here at this time, right? I came 2 years after it opened, so I have to give credit to where it's due. I think thinking about it in this stage is really ahead of the curve of what's next for hospitality. You asked specifically about service. And so when we started, the thought was our service model would be more like an Airbnb.
Right.
And where we landed today, and partially the reason I'm here, is we realized that people really need those touch points. And so we've elevated that to actually be able to work with the luxury traveler. And so you've got all of the things you would want from a luxury resort in the private spaces that are your homes. And our homes, flats and villas are beautiful. I mean, all the homes have private pools and theaters and all of these things that are just incredible. So they're done right. But ancillary to that, the service has to prevail, right? That doesn't go away. And so it's what Airbnb always wanted.
Yes.
A full destination, all right? A full hospitality-led destination with these type of accommodations in it. And
no,
so
I agree with
here
you.
We are.
I'm from both worlds. I think I'm one of the few, and you are too, that are in both worlds. And I've lived both worlds, and I still do. It's hard to run, you know, the vacation rental homes at a very high level. We're proud we're super hosts and have all these homes at that level, but it takes a lot to do it.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of people that get through all of our checklists, and we try to block out the party people. How do you all do it now? Because in the home, you have 22, 24 people.
Yeah.
It gets a little crazy sometimes, I'm sure, when you have the housekeepers walk in after checkout.
I have to tell you, I think that price is an advantage. So, you know, at filter. Some level, you kind of can filter on its own at a certain price point.
Yep.
And so we're lucky in that that doesn't harm us that often.
I'm happy to hear that for you. We're doing that. We have a $5,000 night place. I was like, oh, my God, these NFL players. What are they doing here? But so you're doing a great job here. And you mentioned something. Are you looking to grow this brand? Is that what you kind of just said? Like, you're looking to grow ever more?
Without a doubt. Yeah.
Very exciting.
I mean, I've been a I have a GM for Evermore, so I don't need to be one. So my role is the bigger picture of what Evermore is to become. And that's what's really exciting. This is, I mean, you know this very well. Orlando, Florida is one of the most complex vacation markets, the largest vacation market on the planet, but it's also the most complex because you not only have the second, Vegas has a few more hotel rooms, but we're number two, more than New York, hotel rooms, and then have over 50,000 vacation rentals. So you're figuring that out. If you can do it in Orlando, you can lift the concept and put it anywhere. And so that's the beauty of how to scale Evermore.
I'm excited for you on that. So you kind of touched on it. I'm not asking for your five-year plan, but what are you most excited about in the next 12 months?
So there's a couple things. Number one is really watching Evermore come into its own. Year three is where independents really flourish, right? And because you don't have a brand behind you. So you first is about how do you make everybody understand who you are and why they should visit? And it was even more complicated for Evermore because we were a new concept. And so year two, you're kind of getting that under you. But year three, you become what you were intended to do. And so I want to grab hold of year three. It started really well. We need to continue with that pace. We need to be elevating everything we do. You know, development process, people think it happens overnight. You know that it takes a long time to go from one to many. So we're in year three. So one of the things that people don't realize is that we still have about 700 acres that are developable.
Wow.
So when you think about that, that is massive. And we're in the early stages of what did that become? So that's kind of the next part of how Evermore grows. And then it's starting to really lean into what destinations come next and why. So
I love it. I'm so excited now. I didn't know all this. I'm so glad that I get to learn this with you, Elizabeth. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's really fun.
So we talked about a lot of things. We talked about your journey. We talked about you traveling the world. But if you could go back to young Elizabeth, who is a server at the Lobster Shack, burning her hand on the fryer, what advice are you giving her today if she was starting out today?
So I would say a couple of things. First of all, if I'm talking to Elizabeth at the Lobster Shack, I'm saying two things. don't get burnt in the flyer, in the fryer. And secondarily is don't spend all of your paycheck at the bar. Like, you know, pay your rent first. So that's to that, Elizabeth. It was actually, now to people that have really started in the hospitality business, I would say a few things. Number one, I'd say, trust your instinct. You know, trust your instinct, but don't be afraid. So trust it. You're going to feel if it's good. Then you're going to come up with a million reasons in your head why you shouldn't do it. But your first thought was you do this and trust that and take the leap. So many of us stop because the noise in our head convinces us that we can't do it. When in actuality, I'm here to say you can and you will, and you'll be great at it. And so that's the first one. The second one is your voice belongs in the room. And I say this to men and women. A lot of people think I'm just talking to women when I say this, but it's men and women. There are so many ideas that you're going to have. And if you never tell them or talk about them, then no one will know. And so you'll sit and you'll think, my idea never gets completed, but you told no one. And that's why. And so when it comes to ideas, I often say that there's two things that happen. Sometimes the idea is not right because the timing's not right. And so I will tell you, I've got an idea list and it comes. I mean, I've had this list for 10 years and I will take things from my idea list to this day off of that 10-year list and put them in action because now I see that there's white space in the market and now that idea belongs. So don't be afraid of you know, owning what you're thinking. And when you own that, own also what you want to do. I remember starting off, and it was my husband's. We weren't married at the time, so I guess my boyfriend's best friend. He would always add that people would ask me, what do you want to be? And I would say, I want to be a general manager. And he looked at me, Hetty, you looked at me and said, don't you think you need to get more realistic goal? And I would say, no, I want to be a general manager. And I let everybody know that. And I wasn't saying, I know that I could do it tomorrow. I was just saying, that's what I want to do. And I think because I said it so pervasively that people may have given me opportunity because they knew that I was tracking for something bigger. And right. So, and that was right from the start. And then I would always say, leadership's hard and it doesn't always feel good, but you got to do the right thing anyway. And so never compromise with your integrity. Always do the right thing. The easy thing may be an easy road, but if it's not right, never take the easy road, take the harder path. And finally, I would say hospitality is actually a lifestyle. And you figure out that lifestyle. And if you can figure out the lifestyle, you're going to love this journey because it's the best business in the world. And what I mean by that is you can't compare yourself to the buddy that's a banker that works from 9 to 5. That's not the way our industry works. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We don't shut down. It doesn't mean you can't have a balanced life. You can. Right. You absolutely can. It's just going to look different than the guy at the bank.
Yes.
But it's going to be so much better. And P.S., the guy at the bank wishes he has your life. So that's what I would say.
Man, like, Elizabeth, I like that you prior planned. I feel like someone gave you a tip over here. And you did a great job. And so listeners of all industries, I want you to just rewind those last 4 minutes of Elizabeth, because those tips you need to write down, save that, because I'm going to go back and re-listen to this on those days that are challenging. I really think you gave some great points for people to listen to. And I think it's a great place just to wrap our conversation. And for listeners, like, we just shared so much here with you. Her entire journey is amazing. She has so many different backgrounds and cultures and so many tips she just shared with you. So pause this, share this with a friend, because that friend is going to thank you that you just shared Elizabeth's story. And if you haven't yet, make sure to check out evermoreresort.com, because you're going to be blown away by what you see online. I am now. I got to get on the Bright Line as soon as I can to come up and see you and have a coffee and stay for a weekend with my kids.
Please do.
because it looks just incredible. And as a hotel nerd, you pulled out that map, by the way. I'm going to need to get one. So behind me, it's blurred out with my camera. But I have all these hotel keys and all these colorful maps and stuff from the 1910s and 20s and 30s that are like that.
Awesome.
I love collecting all those things. So for me, it makes a big deal. But Elizabeth, you are awesome. I appreciate you taking the time to join us, especially with how busy you are. And if somebody wants to connect with you, what's the best place someone can do it? Is it LinkedIn? Is it an email?
Where do you want to connect on LinkedIn? I'm on all the time. So yes,
I love it.
Would love to hear from you. And Steve, this has been so fun. I loved your questions. It was just a joy.
Well, I appreciate it. Elizabeth, I'll see you soon. And thanks again for doing this with us.
Thank you. Goodbye.
This podcast is brought to you by Biscayne Coffee. Biscayne Coffee was founded with a giving spirit and a big idea: to enjoy delicious coffee roasted in Miami while helping save Biscayne Bay and the animals that live there. As a former food and beverage director, I can assure you these are some of the best quality beans on the planet. 10% of every coffee sold is donated to nonprofits to help preserve Biscayne Bay for all to enjoy. Visit BiscayneCoffee.com today and use promo code MENTOR at checkout to save 10% on your first order. Drink good coffee and create a good outcome.